Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, novelist Tony White on his latest book, The Fountain in the Forest. Tony White is the author of 5 novels, including Foxy T, previously literary editor of The Idler. He has written for The Guardian and The New Statesman, and recently collaborated with artist Blast Theory on the library's live streaming project, A Place Free of Judgment. White was creative entrepreneur in residence in the French department at King's College London, and has been writer in residence at UCL CIS and at the Science Museum. And we should also mention that Tony is currently chairing the board of our own radio station, Resonance FM. And Tony's latest novel, which we're going to talk about today, is The Fountain in the Forest. Tony, welcome to Little Atoms.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on. It's good to see you.
So how would you describe The Fountain in the Forest?
The Fountain in the Forest is the first of 3 novels which explore the immediate aftermath of the miners' strike, or let's say the 90 days immediately following the miners' strike, between the end of the strike and the Battle of the Beanfield on the 1st of June 1985. The Battle of the Beanfield, of course, was when couple of hundred vehicles travelling to the Stonehenge Free Festival in June, on June the 1st, was forced off the road, ambushed effectively by the Wiltshire police, vehicles destroyed and property destroyed, families separated, 500 plus arrests, the largest civilian mass arrest, I gather, in British history outside of the Second World War. And The Fountain in the Forest is a detective story. It's set in London right now. It's set in the south of France in the mid-1980s. And at the Battle of the Beanfield itself. And the novel picks up with Detective Sergeant Rex King, who works out of the Serious Crime Command at Holborn Police Station. And he's been called to an incident backstage at the Royal Palace Theatre. A body has been found in the paint frame, a Georgian scene painting studio, which in fact belongs to a mate of Rex's. And the novel kicks off with that.
And so far, so crime novel, but this book also follows in the tradition of the French literary technique, oulipo.
Yes.
Tell us what that is.
Okay, yes, oulipo is the short name for a group of international writers that was formed in France in the 60s, and it stands for Ouvrage de Littérature Potentielle, oulipo for short, the workshop of potential literature. And this is a group of writers including Harry Matthews, Georges Perec, who's probably the most well-known of the oulipo group, and others who believed or thought it would be interesting to apply mathematical, scientific and other experimental techniques, which they called constraints, to the production of literature. And Perec is probably the best known of the oulipo writers, and he's best known for his novel La Dispersion, which is translated by Gilbert Adair into English as A Void, which I always thought was a slightly unfortunate title for a Georges Perec novel, because you want to do anything but avoid it. It's brilliant. But A Void, La Dispersion, is a novel that's written without using the letter E. That was the constraint that was applied to the novel. That is a detective novel as well. But it's also kind of a novel about the Holocaust. It's a terribly interesting, important work. It's also incredibly funny, witty, and generous, which makes it all the more poignant. Other constraints that Ulipo proposed include a mandated vocabulary, which means that the words that are going to be used to create a work of literature have to be predetermined in advance. And that's been used particularly by Harry Matthews, among others, for a number of short stories. But I had always had a feeling that the mandated vocabulary was a constraint that hadn't really been explored to its full effect in the novel.
And so that is the technique that you choose to use. And particularly what you've done here is you've not only chosen a particular set of mandated vocabulary, but that's particularly located in time as well, in terms of the time at which the book is set.
It is, it is. When I was researching the novel over a number of years, particularly working in the archives, or with the archives, because the archives of Leeds Other Paper are a series of bound volumes that are kept in Leeds City Library, and also the Guardian archives from the period, I kept finding myself drawn to the back pages of the newspaper as I was kind of scrolling through the microfiches up at Colindale, the big old fabulous warehouse where the newspaper collection reading room used to be, which is now closed, and subsequently in the new newspaper reading room at the British Library. I found myself drawn to the back pages of the Guardian because in the mid 1980s I used to faithfully by the Guardian every day, you know. And the first thing I would do when I got back home or to wherever I was going with the newspaper would be open it to the back page, you know, unfold it, fold it back around itself and do the quick crossword. I used to do that every day. But then in those days, the Guardian only cost about 10p. And as I was reading through these old issues of the Guardian, I found myself drawn to those back pages again, the Steve Bell cartoons, the crosswords, and I just thought, you know, I think I remember this crossword. Maybe it would be amusing to redo one of them. And so I did. But what I wasn't prepared for was this kind of Proustian rush of memories and associations, you know, that came with it. And remembering that Perec, amongst other literary works that he produced, he's an incredibly prolific writer, he compiled a weekly crossword for a Parisian news journal. I just sort of made that connection with the mandated vocabulary and thought, wouldn't it be interesting if these crossword solutions, these words that I'd written out on the back of a newspaper 30 years before, could be used as a mandated vocabulary? And because it's kind of a gift to a novelist, this period of 90 days with a cataclysmic event at the start, the miners' strike, and a cataclysmic event at the end, the Battle of the Beanfield, and these two events, which may be connected even. And just for a novelist, you know, to kind of be able to inhabit that space, this defined space, and try and bring it to life in a piece of fiction is a gift, you know. So I took this one step further and thought, well, actually, if I'm mapping this trilogy, because The Fountain in the Forest is the first of three novels, against a 90-day period, each chapter can be mapped against a day in 1985. And so The Fountain in the Forest is a novel of 30 chapters, and each chapter has to be written using all of the crossword solutions from the Guardian quick crossword on that day in 1985.
And so how does that actually work in practice? And it seems like a fun conceit to set yourself. But in terms of working with that, was there any time, I mean, give us an example of where you really struggled with one.
It was all a struggle. I mean, every single word was a struggle, but hopefully that doesn't show, you know, when you read the book. There was nothing playful about it at all. It was incredibly rigorous, kind of torture, you know. But the really strange thing was that I'd done most of the research for the novel before producing the mandated vocabulary. And strangely, things started to fall into place, you know, almost as if the novel was predestined, you know. So for example, chapter 20, when we're in occupied Nice, you know, at the collapse of the Italian occupation, and just as the Nazis are about to take over, various bits, various words kind of came into play, you know, that seemed to almost have been hiding there in plain sight all along, just waiting for me to turn them into this this chapter, because it's a chapter that deals with a baker, a kind of peasant baker in up in the mountains above Nice, Monsieur Junot, and his kind of quest to get to see this kind of legendary kind of prototype electrical oven that's been produced by the Italian safe makers Conforti, the Conforti Group, which they have brought to Nice for this kind of swan song, kind of fascist esposizione of kind of Italian industrial triumphs that's to be held on the beach at Nice, but which is kind of interrupted by the collapse of Mussolini's regime. And here in chapter 19, we have the word safe, we have the word cook. And these words, which seem to kind of just have been waiting there, ready for this story to be written. So on the one hand, it was kind of torture, but on the other hand, it seemed to be predestined in a very strange way. And I think there's a kind of connection as well with, you know, a kind of literary precedent, I suppose, for this kind of use of a mandated vocabulary, which can be seen in the novels of Italo Calvino, particularly The Castle of Crossed Destinies, which is a novel in which each story, everything in the novel is produced from two hands of tarot card. He deals the tarot deck into a grid and then reads across the pictures and uses those to generate a story. This is a book that I read at the time as well, in the mid-1980s, because Picador were bringing out these beautiful kind of paperbacks of Calvino at the time. And in his author's note at the end, he talks about, which I'd obviously kind of taken on board but completely forgotten about, and then when I looked at it a couple of months ago, it kind of blew me away, because he talked about the tarot cards as a kind of crossword. And this was a sort of machine for generating stories, for generating literature, which was exactly what I'd been feeling about the Fountain in the Forest, the mandated vocabulary that I was using in the Fountain in the Forest. But what's interesting about the Calvino novel, and what is made explicit by his use of the tarot, is that there's some kind of almost like a divinatory sort of element to this laying down of particular words or particular images.
So as well as the mandated vocabulary in terms of the crossword answers, you also mentioned this book is a book of 30 chapters. Each is set on a day, and that day follows the French Revolutionary calendar. Tell us what that is.
It does. The French Revolutionary calendar was developed in the run-up to the French Revolution by an anarchist playwright named Sylvain Maréchal. He felt that there needed to be a non-hierarchical, secular calendar with no days dedicated to royalty or gods, but everything on a level and everything rational. And he proposed 10-day weeks. The days of the week would just be called day one, day two, day three, day four, etc. And that there would be a new month names through the year. Things like Brumaire is the most familiar to the students of Karl Marx, perhaps. And these were related to seasonal changes, the days of the names of the months. And each day in the calendar is also dedicated to an item of everyday rural life, a tool, a foodstuff, a crop, livestock, and thus every day celebrates everyday life, but also in a timely fashion. It's a kind of an almanac in a way. There were two things that kind of drew me to the Revolutionary calendar. One was my initial interest, in fact, was piqued by or provoked by the artist Stuart Brisley, the British artist Stuart Brisley, who had approached me to talk about a hitherto unacknowledged aspect of his work at the time, which was that since the 1970s he had been making a series of performances that were 10 days long, as an explicit reference to the revolutionary calendar. And we spoke about this through a series of conversations while I was doing my residency at King's. And he saw this as a kind of a framework in which a kind of revolutionary performance could take place. So that idea was part of the inspiration. But it was also kind of mechanical, you know, that here was a way of looking at time differently, a way of throwing time up into the air, not needing to plod through events in a literal fashion, but to be able to move backwards and forwards in time. But also, you know, these 90 days between the end of the miners' strike and the Battle of the Beanfield, if you look at that through the lens of the French Revolutionary calendar, it's 9 revolutionary weeks. And that just begged a huge question to me: revolutionary how? And that was the question that the writing of the novel within that framework that I attempted to answer.
And indeed, there was a certain revolution going on at those times, but not necessarily one that we would
yes, exactly. And I think even in the literal sense of a kind of rotation, you know, the kind of gun sights, if you like, of this kind of the state violence that had been visited upon the miners, you know, this once that enemy within, as they were infamously called, had been defeated, a new enemy had to be found. And here, in this convoy of people travelling to the Stonehenge Festival, they were found, and the techniques perhaps that had been used on the miners' strike were applied to this new kind of new civilian group.
So your main protagonist is Rex King, King King.
Yes.
We should say, we'll just let that hang there. And normally I would say, who is he? Tell us something about him. But really, who he is the central story of the book. So we won't go too much into that. And instead, let's talk about the investigation that he's taking part in to begin with in the book, mm-hmm. which is Hazen, who turns out to be his friend, Terry Hobbs, is either, we don't know whether he's the victim or the perpetrator of,
yes.
of this crime at the beginning. The whole investigation is very, for want of a better word, forensic. You know, you seem to have done a lot of research into the, you know, the various acronyms and the workings of the close workings of a police investigation. Tell me something about doing that.
Yes, I was very interested in Rex being a kind of straight up guy, a kind of a policeman who does it by the book, who's been through all the training. He has as you say, an interesting background in the force. But he really plays it by the book, and his friend Webster, you know, Eddie Webster, who's the chief investigating officer on the investigation. They're friends, kind of, but they've come up through the system together. They were in the at Hendon together, came up through their training together, and they have a kind of shorthand. I'm sort of interested in those kinds of micro dialects and the way that language gets used in the workplace, the way that official names of things are subverted and used as a kind of banter. And this is something that you can observe in real life. 20 years ago, I worked for the post office. When I first left art school and had a young family to support, I worked for the post office first at St Pancras Way, the big NW1 sorting office that used to be there, and then up in Upper Street in the old N1 sorting office. And there were little micro-dialect differences between these offices that were only kind of a mile apart, but where that had had quite insulated workforces for a century or so. And so in the Camden office, overtime was known as gobble for some reason, you know, whereas in the Islington office it was known as fat. You go to a post office outside of London, like the post office in Bristol, and there they'd call it docket, you know. And these little kind of differences and investments in language and banter I find very interesting. And in the police force, even though all of the operations within Holborn Police Station completely fictional, there's not you know a scrap of this in terms of the organizational structure, etc., that's real, it's all fiction. None of the cases are real, but these kind of acronyms and the language and the way that they used was kind of my, I suppose, a kind of educated guess about how people interact and where they find humor. And and so Rex and Eddie have a kind of bantering relationship, and that kind of plays out in spite of the seriousness of the investigation, if you like.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Tony White. We're talking about his latest novel, The Fountain in the Forest. And you said there that Rex is a police officer that likes to play it by the book. But another one of the strands of this story is this hanging over him, this often example of an unlawful killing of a black man that's happened in police custody, Trevor Tennyson.
Well, Rex is the kind of station lead for safety and detention, and so he has a kind of an administrative role in the Holborn Police Station for, you know, monitoring safety and detention, monitoring incidents and use of force incidents, UFOs as they're sometimes known. And that's all sort of fine, just about manageable within the kind of the working hours he has available to him. But what is coming up, they learn at the beginning of the novel, is a full-on SIC, which is a safety and custody inspection, which is a kind of United Nations-level kind of diplomatic investigation that involves all the constabularies and takes, you know, is a very rigorous kind of... It goes through all of these kind of safety procedures and training with a fine-tooth comb, interviewing prisoners, etc. And that's on the horizon. But then somehow... At the beginning of the novel, some information is leaked about the Tennyson case. A young man who was arrested at a protest and who died in restraint in Holborn Police Station. This is a fictional case, I should stress, but this is something that happens quite regularly, unfortunately. And if anyone who's interested in finding out about deaths in police custody or following other contact with the police should look at the resources and the website of Inquest, which is the charity that do a very difficult job of campaigning for victims' families of these kinds of deaths, but also of monitoring and publishing data and keeping regularly updated figures to do with these kinds of deaths in the public domain. And so it seems to me that if you're writing a novel about the police, if you're writing a detective story and you're not reflecting that aspect of contemporary policing, I don't think you're doing your job. So for me, it was really important that an incident of this nature is unfolding in the fictional police station within the novel. And Rex, as safety and detention lead, is part of a series of meetings that are exploring the implications of this leak of some new documents relating to the Tennyson case.
I want to take us to the middle section of the book, and we're back in the early 80s in the south of France.
Yes.
This part is set in an abandoned village that has become like a little social experiment, commune, if you will.
Yeah.
And again, this is incredibly vividly recreated. Tell us something about this place, this area.
Yes, this is a fictional village of La Fontaine en Forêt, which is up the mountains, maybe sort of a few miles north and further up the mountain from Vence, in the mountains above Nice. It's a very interesting area. It's an area that's associated with artists. You know, it's the Vence and its surroundings is where kind of Matisse lived, the village of Tourette a little further up the hill. But at the time, it was also in the mid-80s, March 1985, when a young Englishman abroad named JJ arrives in Cagnes-sur-Mer, having travelled down from the UK on a little kind of award he got at sixth form. It's under construction. You know, there's a huge motorway that's being built along the coast And so the production of this road, which is going to link Aix-en-Provence, where Cézanne, you know, famously painted Montagne de Sainte-Victoire, with Italy motorway. So this is being built. And so in the midst of the beautiful French Riviera and the forested hills and mountains above, and these great limestone crags known as the Bows, there's a kind of veil of noise of production, you know, that's going on all the time. And the village of La Fontaine-en-Forêt is kind of built around the idea that it's not unreasonable, actually, if you look at how settlements formed in that part of France. They tend to form around a spring or a water source, and in a site that's defendable. So Vence itself is a kind of fortified hilltop town built around a spring, as indeed further up the mountain is the village of Tourette-sous-Loup. And what I sort of proposed with La Fontaine-en-Forêt is that there's a further village a little way up the mountains at La Fontaine beneath a fictional kind of crag, Bao La Fontaine. This is a village that was abandoned after the Second World War. There's just one person left living there, and a group of artists, academics, Potter and various others have kind of moved in and begun to kind of restore this village, to try and live a kind of revolutionary life, living their life by the revolutionary calendar. JJ, this young Englishman, he's slightly he's got no real reason to go back to the UK, and he, you know, is invited to stay for a night in this incredible village, this incredible spot, and he gets to like it and sort of wants to find a kind of a métier, you know, and a reason, you know, a reason to stay there. And so that the middle section of the novel, you know, we get to know this place, the way of life there, its history, you know, which goes back to the Second World War and the Italian and the Nazi occupations. JJ falls in love. He falls in love with Sylvie. And here we have the mandated vocabulary kind of comes into play, you know. And as I was writing this, I knew that, you know, the 10th chapter of this sequence would have to feature the words erect, in flagrante delicto, arc. It was inevitable somehow that JJ and Sylvie would get together. There was romance in the air. It was written in the crossword solutions.
Just one more thing from me then, and then I'll get you to read a bit if you would.
Okay.
You've mentioned already that this is the first of a trilogy.
Yes.
So what can we expect next?
We'll see a lot more of Detective Sergeant Rex King. And actually, because the crosswords are all done, the mandated vocabulary is there, I'm well into volume two. I can tell you that in chapter 12 or chapter 22 of volume two, we are back in the Riviera. We'll be back in the south of France. And in, I think it's chapter 12 of volume three, a very significant character from The Fountain in the Forest will return, and that will really set the cat among the pigeons.
If you would read us some, then just tell us what you're going to read.
I'm going to read a little extract from, which is about 2 minutes long perhaps, from the beginning of the novel. It's Rex. Since we were talking about Rex, I thought I'd read a little bit of Rex. And this is chapter two, which is dedicated to hedge mustard, Velar, the herb. And here we find Rex in the morning, and right now, today, Rex King had other things on his mind, and top of the list was coffee. Having got home after midnight and wound down for longer than he had planned, Rex had awoken with a hangover that was roughly commensurate, emphasis on rough, with the bottle of industrial Australian Shiraz he had finished at 1:30 in the morning. He had just about had time for a shit and a shower, but not enough to load up the stovetop pot and make his usual espresso. There were plenty of cafes and restaurants to choose from around here, but Rex liked to put his money, such as it was, the way of local businesses who paid their taxes, rather than filling the non-dom coffers of the more ubiquitous chains that didn't. He wasn't an unreconstructed food philistine like some of his colleagues, but given the choice, Rex would go for a good fillet steak and chips over confit of onglet on a salad of wild hedge mustard every time. For even simpler fare, bacon sandwich simple. Sid's was hard to beat. It opened early too. Situated where they were, between a hospital and a cop shop, the staff at Sid's were ready to cater to those clocking off nights or onto early shifts, and they had a sizeable menu. They also did good coffee, unlike the majority of builders-type cafes in London, where coffee often meant a spoonful of Nescafe dissolved in boiling water and topped up with milk. The late spring air was fresh enough to cut through his hangover a little, but the headache was only compounded by lack of sleep. He'd been too drunk to seriously practice any of the relaxation techniques that Helen had once taught him. Imagine that the in-breath is a wave, breathe out quickly through your teeth. So he'd been unable to stop his mind from racing, replaying and dissecting the events of the day. At 3 a.m, he had realized he was still awake and listening to the steady, duple beat, usually inaudible, of the kitchen clock. Sitting outside Sid's with the Guardian on the table in front of him, folded up and unread, crossword not even started, and his coffee and a bacon sandwich on white toast on the way, there was plenty to think about. 3 conflicting narratives that would be competing for his attention in the coming days, if not weeks and months. Firstly, there was his old friend Terry Hobbs, who was suddenly, astonishingly, front runner to be the lead suspect in a murder investigation. Then there was the news of the safety in custody inspection. Now, cherry on the cake, Tennyson was about to be dumped in the public domain all over again. The first of these was puzzling, but Rex had been loudly relieved when it became apparent that at least it wasn't Hobbs's body they had found the previous day. The missing friend still hadn't returned Rex's call, but knowing Terry as he did, Rex had told Eddie that he was as confident as a bent bookie at Newmarket, that Hobbs couldn't have done it, that he'd be willing to bet a year's salary there'd be no forensic evidence, not a single fingerprint, to link Tell to whoever it was that had been killed in the Royal Palace Theatre paint frame. The second, Rex was less worried about the outcome of any inspection than about the rigours and the burden of the SIC itself. Like he didn't already have enough to do without having to accommodate a bunch of apparatchiks with clipboards crawling all over everything. He knew that he had kept a tight ship on SD, so it was just a matter of putting his head down and submitting to the forthcoming process, speaking when spoken to, framing every response within the relevant regulation and not obstructing them in any way. Easier said than done, but not impossible. That just left Tennyson.
I've been talking to Tony White about his latest novel, The Fountain in the Forest. It's out now from Faber in the UK. Tony, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you, Neil. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.